This is what we're worried about. This styrofoam is just going to get all ground up. And you can see there's just the billions, trillions of little bits of styrofoam scattered all over everything.
Assessing the tsunami debris problem in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, students and teachers talk about the impact of the proposed Anchorage School District cuts.
If we cut these counselors, our graduation rates that they want to go up are going to go down. Kids are going to get frustrated and they'll be done.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
The state of Alaska's sexual assault case against former Bristol Bay Native Corporation board member Sergey Chukwak has been dismissed. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
46-year-old Sergey Chukwak had been charged with sexually assaulting a woman in Naknek on November 5th last year. Anchorage District Attorney Sharon Marshall dismissed that case Tuesday. Doug King is an assistant district attorney in Dillingham.
At this time, the Department of Law has determined, after a thorough review of all the available evidence, that it cannot prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. While the charges have been dismissed, the investigation remains open.
Chukwak was arrested on the 8th of November, and the Bristol Bay Borough Police began an investigation. But the victim of the alleged assault died on the 18th of November, and the state's case against Chukwak began to unravel. Charges were reduced to misdemeanor assault to give the prosecutors time to present a case for felony sexual assault to a grand jury for an indictment, but without the testimony of the alleged victim, the case never moved forward. Chukwak has maintained his innocence, which his attorney Wally Tietlow of Anchorage says the dismissed charges confirm. Chukwak had served on the Bristol Bay Native Corporation Board of Directors since 2010, but resigned in late November on account of the allegations. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission has approved a consent agreement worked out by its staff and former Anchorage Assembly member Dan Coffey. APOC staff say he failed to register as a lobbyist for the municipality of Anchorage and then made illegal campaign contributions to legislative candidates outside his own district. Under the agreement, Coffey admits he violated the law, and the staff recommends a reduction of the maximum possible fine from $46,500 to $13,000. Coffey says he thought he didn't have to be registered if he limited his hours of lobbying activities. Coffey's job was to try to get the legislature to pay for the cost overruns at the Port of Anchorage. Refrigerators, styrofoam buoys, and even ketchup bottles are piling up on Alaska's beaches. It's debris from the devastating Japanese tsunami in the spring of 2011. One of the hardest hit beaches is on Montague Island at the entrance to Prince William Sound. APRN's Annie Feit visited the beach last weekend with a marine debris expert and has this story.
The beach on the southeast side of Montague Island stretches for nearly 80 miles of pristine wilderness. At least it looks pristine from a few thousand feet up. As our helicopter descends towards the shore, big chunks of white styrofoam come into view.
Yeah, you can see all the big globs of styrofoam. That's all tsunami debris. Yeah, there's more styrofoam out here. There's no question.
Chris Ballister would know. He's president of the nonprofit Gulf of Alaska Keeper. The group has been cleaning up marine debris that washes onto Alaska's shores for 11 years. And when the tsunami debris began arriving last spring, their job got a whole lot harder. Ballister has visited Montague Island nearly a dozen times since then. And by the time we land and step onto the pebble beach, he's shaking his head in disgust.
I mean, you're basically standing in a landfill out here.
Ballister points to an area scattered with styrofoam bits smaller than packing peanuts.
So you see what's happening here with all the crushed up styrofoam now? This is what we're worried about. This styrofoam is just going to get all ground up. And you can see there's just be billions, trillions of little bits of styrofoam scattered all over everything. And, you know, extrapolate that all up and down this coastline. It's kind of an impossible job.
The trash is not just an eyesore. Pallister says voles, birds, and even bears are eating the styrofoam and plastic. He's also worried about chemicals. Among the debris, he finds containers that held kerosene, gas, and other petroleum products. Even the little containers worry him. Sifting through the trash, he picks up a small blue bottle and unscrews the cap to inspect its contents.
I have no idea what this was. It looks like just dish soap, maybe, laundry detergent, but it's empty, which is maybe not a good sign. But there's thousands of bottles like this all up down the coast, from small household chemical items to drums full of chemicals, big industrial-sized drums.
Marine debris is not a new issue in Alaska, but the Japanese tsunami has magnified the problem many times over. Pallister says the tsunami debris doesn't have the visceral impact of the Exxon Valdez spill, with oiled animals and blackened coastlines. But he thinks in the long run, it could be a bigger environmental disaster.
In a lot of ways, it's a lot worse than the oil spill, both in the geographic scope of it and the chemicals that are coming with it. And who knows what the impacts are going to be. And they're going to be really difficult to measure because they're spread out spatially. And, you know, it's going to be a very difficult scientific issue to sort that all out, I think.
Officially, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has only recorded 20 tsunami debris items that have landed in Alaska. But the agency will only confirm an object if it has a unique identifier that can be traced back to Japan. The state of Alaska does not use the same strict standard. Last summer, the state paid for an aerial survey to inspect 2,500 miles of Alaska's coastline. Elaine Bussey Floyd is acting director of the Division of Environmental Health. She says the survey identified tsunami debris all along the flight path from southern southeast up to Prince William Sound and out the Alaska Peninsula.
There was tsunami debris literally on every beach that was photographed. They took over 8,000 pictures, and it was more widespread and greater quantities than we even expected.
But so far, there has been minimal funding for cleaning up the debris. Governor Sean Parnell didn't include any tsunami debris funding in his budget. NOAA is figuring out how to distribute a $5 million gift from Japan. And Alaska's congressional delegation is working to get federal funds. But tsunami debris cleanup money was stripped from a bill for Hurricane Sandy relief that passed this week.
Look at this mess here.
Back on the beach, as the waves crash in, Chris Pallister says the debris could have serious impacts on fisheries and subsistence resources.
I don't know if it's being taken seriously enough. I don't think a lot of people that are going to be impacted by it know how bad it is right now. And until that gets out, maybe not much is going to happen. But I think we're kind of getting to the tipping point now where a lot of people in the state and federal agencies realize the gravity of this situation, and they're all working pretty hard now to get a handle on the scope of the problem and trying to develop funding sources. But as of yet, that hasn't happened.
Pallister guesses it will take tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars to remove the debris. On this day, though, he has to leave it all on the island.
All right, we better go back.
Okay.
We take off in the helicopter and head north along the beach. Pallister looks out the window at all the debris below and says it just goes on and on and on. On Montague Island, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the public weighs in on the governor's oil tax plan.
We're not the tax experts. We don't know how to do it, but we do know that something's wrong. There's something out of balance that needs to be fixed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The Anchorage School District Superintendent has recommended a budget which eliminates more than 200 jobs. Professions that could be hit especially hard are counselors and advisors. KSKA's Daisha Eaton visited Service High School, where staff and students are worried about the impact of the cuts.
Johnny Mazzoros loves baseball.
My passion for baseball is very, very strong. I'm working out at lunchtime, weight training, LPF. I probably put in as much as a full-time job playing baseball.
The Cougars pitcher is set to graduate from Service High School this spring and has a full ride to play college baseball at Central Arizona University. But things weren't always on track for him. In 10th grade, he was dabbling in drugs and lost focus.
I wasn't passing any classes, and I was getting in trouble. I was getting suspended. And then I got in trouble for good. I got expelled.
He was expelled, but allowed to come back after a semester. The 17-year-old lost valuable time and is making up more than a semester's worth of credits in order to graduate. For Christian Alvarado, it wasn't moving that pushed him off track. His parents are from Guatemala. He relocated to Anchorage from Oklahoma when he was in first grade. He hasn't stopped jumping around since.
Since I moved to Anchorage, I probably moved a dozen times. Having to move because of either wanting a different place or a better opportunity or just because I have to because maybe, you know, something went wrong with the lease.
Sometimes Alvarado says he ended up living across town, and because his single mom worked full-time, she usually wasn't around to help him get to and from school.
There's times where I'd really want to go to school and, like, you know, I'd wake up and, like, honestly, I wouldn't have a ride.
As a result, he fell behind. Eventually, he moved in with a classmate's family near Service. The 18-year-old works part-time to contribute to the rent. He says he wants to major in business at UAA, then open his own construction company. But he has a lot of catching up to do first. He has to make up most of his sophomore and junior year by May to graduate. Both Alvarado and Mazzoros get help from Carly Tibbetts.
You know, love, sex, drugs, alcohol, suicide. I have those conversations on a daily basis with my kids.
Tibbetts, who has a master's degree in social work, says she can relate to the students because she also struggled with school. Besides day-to-day counseling, she also manages a credit recovery program to help kids who fall behind. About 1,800 students attend Service High School. Tibbetts says the 75 or so students she works with face serious challenges.
We have kids that are homeless. We have kids that bounce from parent to parent. We have kids that are into drugs. I become their cheerleader, but I'm also that person who calls them when they're not doing what they need to be doing.
Anchorage School District Superintendent Jim Browder has recommended a budget that eliminates more than 200 jobs, including Tibbetts's. He says the cuts are needed to address a $25 million budget shortfall caused by flat funding from the legislature that's not keeping up with inflation and cost of living increases for employees. Jodette Nock teaches math at Service High School. Her job is not in jeopardy, but she thinks one of the district's primary goals is.
If we cut these counselors, our graduation rates that they want to go up are going to go down. Kids are going to get frustrated. They have nowhere to turn. And they'll be done.
The district's comprehensive plan calls for a graduation rate of 90% by 2020. The rate has been stuck in the 60 to 75% range for nearly a decade. Nock also worries that fewer counselors will put more pressure on teachers.
I have 34 kids in a classroom. How much more do you want me to do? I've got 6 languages spoken, and if I'm the lone support person, it's going to be really hard for these kids. I don't know what the answers are, but I'm pretty sure it's not to cut the counseling support staff.
Browder's budget recommends eliminating 28 full-time positions in counseling services out of 132. Reducing the number to 104 district-wide. That includes doing away with all 8 graduation coaches and all 8 high school career resource advisors. Superintendent Browder says compared to other districts, Anchorage has more counselors, and many of the programs that employ them were initially paid for by grants, which have run out. What Browder says he envisions is fewer counselors per school who are generalists, sort of super counselors that can handle anything.
Anybody inside of the suite should be able to handle any issue. And I think we're realigning in a way that will provide better service for parents, students, and the school itself as we move forward.
Back at Service High School, the kids who benefit from the graduation coach say they don't know what they'd do without her. Johnny Mazuros says he wouldn't be back in school.
I was planning on dropping out my sophomore year. I actually got kicked out of school for drugs and stuff, and she put me on the right track. That's why I'm here right now. We wouldn't have you having this conversation if she wasn't here.
The school board will be accepting public testimony on the proposed 2013-2014 budget on Monday, February 4th, at the Anchorage Education Center, beginning at 6:30 p.m. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
In the legislature, a bill that would increase funding for schools has been introduced. A team of nine Democrats want to peg what's called the base student allocation to inflation. That allocation gives schools $5,680 for every student they have enrolled, and it's remained at the same level for the past 3 years. The funding bill would increase that amount to nearly $6,000 to account for inflation over the past 2 years, and it would permanently tie the allocation to the Consumer Price Index going forward. Representative Harriet Drummond served on the Anchorage School Board before being elected to the legislature. She describes the bill as a way of responding to recent staffing cuts in the district.
The school districts have been cutting for years. They've long since cut any fat, if there ever was any to begin with. They're now cutting certified staff.
House Majority Leader Lance Pruitt is skeptical of the bill's potential to get through the legislature. The Anchorage Republican is concerned the bill would give future legislators less flexibility with the budget in times when less revenue is coming in. He says that changes to the education funding formula would probably have more success if the Democratic minority took a bipartisan approach.
The bill that's out there is more of a political statement than truly addressing the issue. If there was really a desire to see this move forward and not just be an opportunity to talk to you guys, then you would probably see some majority members' names on there.
Pruitt thinks the governor's plan to keep the base student allocation at the same level is a good starting point. The public got its first chance to comment on the governor's proposal to cut taxes on oil companies this week. His bill would get rid of a provision that oil companies pay more when profits are high, and it would tie credits to production instead of exploration. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
If you only listen to the first half hour of public comment on the governor's proposal to restructure the state's oil taxes, you would have heard a lot of this.
We are in support of Senate Bill 21.
We do support the governor's bill.
Just to be clear, we do support the principles in the governor's bill.
Representatives from mining, timber, and trucking groups showed up at the Capitol in person, and they packed the hearing room. They were first in line to speak before the Senate Special Committee on Oil Production, and their support for the governor's bill was nearly unanimous. Many made the point that the governor's bill could discourage oil companies from leaving Alaska for states with lower tax rates. Aves Thompson, who lobbies for the Alaska Trucking Association, was among them.
We're not the tax experts. We don't know how to do it, but we do know that something's wrong. There's something out of balance that needs to be fixed. And it is our firm belief that it needs to be fixed now.
Once the committee started taking testimony over the phone from legislative information offices across the state, opinion diversified. About half of those callers criticized the governor's plan to get rid of a windfall profits tax and overhaul the way credits are awarded, with a number calling the bill a giveaway to oil companies. One of those comments came from a voice that was very involved in last year's oil tax debate. For 2.5 minutes, former legislator Joe Pasquin testified that oil companies could take advantage of the tax cut to ramp up production without reinvesting in new infrastructure and exploration, something he described as super harvest mode. He also suggested that the argument that the current tax structure is behind the drop in oil production is a red herring.
The throughput decline started in 1989 and it has nothing to do with tax policy.
Pasquin was one of the senators who opposed Parnell's previous attempts to lower taxes on oil companies, and he lost his seat in November. The TAP's throughput committee has scheduled a 6-hour meeting on Thursday where they will take more public testimony. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
Eagle human relations in Unalaska are usually peaceful, but can turn violent as eagles protect their nests in the spring. As KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, the city recently took preemptive action to ward off future attacks.
Unalaska may be the only place in the world where eagle attacks are a relatively common occurrence. Clinic director Eileen Conlon-Scott says there's at least one person who ends up needing treatment every year.
Nothing serious where they had to be medevaced, but still, it's very frightening to somebody to be attacked from the back and not know what hit them.
One of the nests that sent the most people to the clinic over the years is, ironically, on a cliff right in front of the building. The intrepid eagle vanquisher's name is Mikkel Saunders. He's not an eagle nest removal specialist or even a wildlife expert. Normally, he does blasting work for the company that's clearing the site for Unalaska's new wastewater treatment plant. But for the past week, he's been applying those skills to demolishing eagle nests, starting with the clinic one.
All of the nesting debris and all that went down off the edge of the cliff, and then we actually pried the rock outcropping right off. So it's no longer a ledge. It's a lot steeper.
The whole process took just a few days in contrast to the many months of permitting leading up to it. Chris Hoffman is a consultant who helped the city obtain the permits from the Fish and Wildlife Service. The clinic one was free because the nest was deemed a hazard to public safety, but the other nest, which is in the way of a proposed pedestrian path, cost the city $15,000. But Hoffman says it's fortunate that there's even a legal way to get rid of them.
Up until a few years, it wasn't possible to remove them, really under any circumstances.
The government might have started giving permits to remove nests, but those don't come with instructions on how to actually do it. Which is why, back out in the field at the second nesting site, Saunders is holding an armful of chicken wire.
Right now we're building a cone of wire to keep the eagles from landing on this outcropping right here.
The outcropping is just a little sliver of rock poking out over Airport Beach Road. Its former inhabitant is sitting just a few feet away.
He's kind of keeping an eye on us, so.
And you said he's been hanging out all day?
Oh yeah, he's pretty interested.
Has he been giving you any trouble?
No, not at all, but definitely curious.
The city paid Advanced Blasting, the company Saunders works for, nearly $15,000 for the 9 days of work he and another technician put in on the two nest sites. With the cost of the permit and the consultant added in, the two nests cost Unalaska around $35,000. Public Works Director Nancy Peterson.
Yeah, it's added up. We thought it was going to be, with each step it would be a lot simpler, but it isn't, and stuff never happens cheaply, unfortunately.
Peterson says that's part of the reason the city has no plans to touch two other eagle attack hotspots, the post office and Captain's Bay Road. So while the clinic might not see any more attacks on its own turf, it will still probably see an eagle patient or two. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Matanuska Valley's dairy industry has shrunk to two farms since the shutdown of the Matanuska Creamery in December. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, a new dairy enterprise may keep them afloat for the time being.
This Matanuska Valley cow may now have a reason to live. The state's Board of Agriculture and Conservation last year approved a $500,000 loan to a Palmer dairy farm. Bob and Jean Havermeister used the money to put in a bottling plant at their farm. The Havermeister dairy plant is operated by their grandson, former financial advisor Ty Havermeister, who's showing off the new plant.
Into that tank, then we've got a cream tank where we can mix half and half, whatever kind of good things are coming out, ice cream mix.
Ty Havermeister points to brightly lit monitors on the wall.
That's your chart recorder right there. I have to record all the temperatures as the milk is being processed. I control the whole plant from that screen. So we produce around 500 gallons a day.
Havermeister Dairy has been supplying Palmer stores since last July and has since expanded into several Anchorage stores, including Fred Meyer. The new bottling plant is keeping the ever-diminishing Matanuska Valley dairy industry alive since the demise of Matanuska Creamery in late December. That's good news for Point Mackenzie farmer Wayne Brost, who will be supplying Havermeister Dairy. He says he's been dumping his milk up to now, but Karen Olson, who is the former CEO and president of the now-defunct Matanuska Creamery, is critical of the board's loan to the Havermeister business. She says the board's action is not helping all the farmers.
The board, in my opinion, just
decided to shrink the dairy industry down to one farm and maybe one other, and they just went ahead and did it. Made the bet, kept it secret. They lent $500,000 to one farm in the valley, and apparently they decided that they wanted to give the best shot to their alternate plan and didn't think that the Point McKenzie farms were worth dealing with.
One other Point McKenzie dairy farm has gone out of business. Olson says one small bottling plant is not an industry, but Olson admits the creamery has not made money or even broken even since 2009. Prost defends the board's action. He says the creamery was behind in payments to him to the tune of $500,000 over the years.
You know, we knew this a long time back. We kept going with them and kept going with them and hoping they could get it turned around and they could pay us at least part of what they owed us. And it just kept getting worse. And it was a real mess that Karen stepped into and tried to make work.
Ty Havermeister, too, says the creamery owed the Havermeisters a considerable amount of money. Brost says if the new business is successful, there's a slim chance that the Valley's dairy industry can survive.
We'll know in a year or two if it works, you know, and if it don't, then we still have the option to kill our cows. But if we jump to conclusions and don't try this processing plant and we kill our cows, then we know we're not going back into business in a couple of years. At least I'm not.
Ty Havermeister says the new business is operating on a small budget with only himself and one employee, as opposed to the Matanuska Creamery's 15 employees. And the fact that the new dairy business is not paying for a rented facility gives it a financial edge. Havermeister says his own cows produce enough to match his market's needs. With Brost's cows coming on board, he says his dairy will have enough milk to expand.
As far as the profitability of this place and staying in business, we'd be fine with just selling our own milk. But I think that if there's a market, then you should sell it. So, and plus, I want to see the dairy industry thrive here, which it really hasn't done in the last few years.
State Agriculture Division Director Francie Havermeister is not commenting on the board's loan. She is related to owners of the Havermeister farm and had recused herself from the board's vote approving the loan. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Ellen Lockyer in Palmer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.